Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Rate of Climb, Thrilling Personal Reminiscences from a Fighter Pilot and Leader, by Air Commodore Rick Peacock Edwards, CBE, AFC, narrated by James Cameron Stewart. Foreword. Rick Peacock Edwards has been a great friend since the heady days when we were both flying the Lightning, and our paths have crossed frequently throughout our respective careers in the Royal Air Force, both No. 11 group commanders at the same time in our careers. Rick has seen more than most in his aviation career, both inside and outside of the service, and this book brings those experiences into sharp relief. The son of a Battle of Britain pilot, flying was obviously in his veins from a very young age, and from his early education in South Africa to joining the RAF, one can already see the drive that eventually took him to high rank. Indeed, he followed the classic fighter pilot path, always striving for excellence when in the cockpit, and never far from trouble when out. Importantly, as you move through his career in such iconic aircraft as the Lightning, Gnat, Phantom, and Tornado, Rick has highlighted candidly not only the wonderful camaraderie and fun that we all had, but the stresses and strains that inevitably beset any large organization. As a flying instructor, flight commander, squadron commander, and then station commander, he is very well equipped to reflect on the Royal Air Force of the day and its readiness to meet the demands of conflict. When wrestled out of a cockpit, which was never for long, his staff appointments were no less demanding, and the listener will get a straightforward and sometimes blunt look at the machinery that kept the Royal Air Force operational. Latterly, he took up the position of Inspector of Flight Safety for the RAF, an independent position in which he reported directly to the Chief of the Air Staff. This vitally important position laid responsibility on him for the overall safety protocols and mechanisms that allowed the RAF to complete the operational mission in the safest manner possible. Many would have treated operations and safety as mutually incompatible, but Rick managed to move forward both very effectively in his normal, pragmatic fashion. His involvement with flight safety opened many doors, such that many years after his retirement, he is still very active in the promotion and management of aviation safety. Indeed, his post-RAF career has been, in many ways, no less interesting than his time in the service. He has filled director and managing director positions. He had a very successful year as Master of the Honorable Company of Air Pilots, and still in 2019, he is patron, president, chairman or vice-chairman of a dozen or so organizations. In particular, I know that he takes great pleasure from his association with the RAF Club in London and his involvement with air displays. However, a short foreword cannot do full justice to the breadth and scope of the very many activities and positions in which Rick Peacock Edwards has been involved. Suffice to say, he brings much colour to all of these activities, as much as you will gain from learning about the spills and thrills of flying some of the most exciting aircraft of his generation. Air Marshal Cliff Spink, CB, CBE, FCMI, FRAES. Introduction. My Father's Wartime Exploits. My father, Spencer Ritchie Peacock Edwards, known as Teddy, was born in Cockstead on the 27th of May, 1915. He later attended Michael House in Natal, South Africa. He was one of 11 candidates selected in southern Rhodesia by a Royal Air Force board to join the RAF on a short service commission. He sailed to the UK and began initial training on the 7th of March, 1938. Posted to 2 FTS Bryce Norton on the 21st of May, and with training completed, he joined No. 150 Squadron Boscombe Down on the 17th of December in the same year, equipped with three-seat Fairey Battles. Pilots of the light bomber found themselves flying in an obsolete death trap, no match for the superior Luftwaffe. Squadron losses were catastrophic. The squadron flew to France on the 2nd of September 1939, and my father was detached to Boscombe Down for a short gunnery course, the 8th to 17th of October. In June 1940, the squadron was evacuated from France and returned to the UK, where he volunteered to serve with Dowding's Fighter Command, and on the 3rd of September, he was posted to No. 615 Squadron at Prestwick to convert to the Hurricane. He moved to No. 253 Squadron, based at Kenley, on the 13th of September, and on the 6th of October, possibly destroyed a Dornier DO-17, unrecorded. On the 21st, he damaged a DO-17, and on the 30th, was credited with damaging the most dangerous enemy, a Messerschmitt ME-109. On the 22nd of November, he damaged another DO-17, and on the 3rd of December, shared in the destruction of a further DO-17. On the 15th of December, destined for the Middle East, he embarked on the aircraft carrier HMS Furious via Liverpool, flying a Hurricane off at Takoradi on the 9th of January 1941. In company with fellow pilots, he flew a Hurricane north on the multi-stage ferry routed to Ismailia, Egypt, from where he flew in a Sunderland to Malta, arriving the 30th of January. Joining No. 261 Squadron at Halfa, he claimed a Junkers Ju-88 destroyed on the 1st of February, was appointed A Flight Commander on the 16th, accounting for two Ju-87s, and damaging another on the 23rd of March. He destroyed an ME-109 on the 13th of April, and then made a forced crash landing in his stricken Hurricane V-7472. In May 1941, he returned to the Middle East Theatre, and from August, instructed at Gordon's Tree OTU, Sudan. Later that year, he joined the pilot pool, Kas Farid. In February 1942, he embarked on HMS Indomitable, taking off at Ceylon on the 7th of March, to join G Squadron, renumbered 258 on the 30th of March. The squadron was scrambled on Easter Sunday, the 5th of April, when Japanese carrier-based aircraft attacked Colombo. He is credited with destroying an enemy naval aircraft and probably a Zero. However, for the second time during the war, he was forced to crash-land his Hurricane in a paddy field and walked away with only minor injuries. Years later, I met the Japanese pilot credited with shooting down my father. He wished to atone for what happened in the war, and it was a memorable and moving meeting which attracted much media interest at the time. Posted to No. 273 Squadron Katakurunda in August 1942, my father was awarded the DFC, gazetted the 29th of December 1942, for his achievements during the Easter Sunday battles. He had been at sea, set on course for Singapore, when it fell to the Japanese oppressor, and that is why he then ended up in Ceylon, then a British crown colony. But for this diversion, he would not have met my mother, Gillian, known as Jill Sheila Armitage, whom he married on the 9th of January 1943 in Ceylon. She was the daughter of a British tea planter. Generations of the family had run a tea estate in Ceylon known as Frowcroft. My mother was educated in the UK and only saw her parents when they came to the UK, which was not very often. Unlike today, there was little capability to return to Ceylon for the school holidays. It must have been hard for my mother and her twin brother Jack, one of my godfathers. They used to go to a holiday home during the school holidays, run by Reverend Hayes and his wife. I know my mother enjoyed her time with this family, who were very kind and loving. One of the sons of Reverend Hayes, Murray, was the other of my two godfathers. He was always very good to me throughout his life, and we had much in common, namely flying and a military background. Murray had been a pilot and commander in the Royal Navy. By February 1943, my father was commanding No. 30 Squadron, equipped with Hurricanes, in Colombo, leading it until April 1944, when he returned to the UK. After the war, the family, that is my parents plus me and my brother John, returned briefly to southern Rhodesia in 1946, before my father then returned to the RAF in 1947. He finally retired from the RAF on the 14th of February 1958 with the rank of squadron leader, and we returned to live permanently in South Africa. My father died in September 1983, and my mother in May 2007. So why, you may ask, am I telling you so much about my parents? My father and his fellow Battle of Britain pilots were my heroes as a child, and remain my heroes to this day. Their way of life has driven my way of life, and continues to do so, and I feel that telling you about my father's flying career stroke exploits will help you understand my own feelings. My mother, likewise, was a very beautiful and lively lady, and incredibly loving. She also liked a good party, and has equally played a major and influential part in my life. Chapter 1. Early Years in the UK. My family can date their ancestral origins to the north of the border, where my forebears still retain a family law practice in Edinburgh. Connections with South Africa began when my grandfather fought in the Boer War and stayed on in the country. My grandfather farmed initially in East Griqualand and later at a very large farm called Broadwell in the Plumtree area, southern Rhodesia. My father had an elder sister, Judy, who for most of her life lived in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, but moved south to Howick in South Africa with her husband John when the Zimbabwe problems started to develop. They were not able to take with them many of their possessions and none of any wealth. They had three children, Anne, who lives in Johannesburg, Christopher, a vet, and who still lives in Zimbabwe, and Margaret, who lives in Northumberland. Judy was my godmother, and a very good one too, and it was she who helped to develop my lifelong interest in stamp collecting. She used to send me all the first day covers when new stamps were introduced in Rhodesia. My mother had a twin brother, Jack Armitage, who definitely had an influence on my life. I was told that he and I were very similar, both in looks and character. He was a great party lover. He was one of my two godfathers, and I've always had the greatest respect for him as a really good chap. His first wife, Audrey, was my favourite aunt. She and Jack had two children, John and Kay, who themselves started life in Ceylon, where Jack was the sixth or seventh generation to run the family tea estate. I see a lot of Kay to this day, and John followed me into the RAF as a pilot. Unfortunately, his very promising career was cruelly cut short when he was killed in a Canberra flying accident on the 3rd of May 1977. He, too, is greatly missed. I can well remember being told, when others discovered that John was a relative, "John Armitage is your cousin, but he is so couth. How can he be your cousin?" I am not sure how to take that one. My other cousin, Kay, who I gave away at her wedding in September 1977, lives very close to me in Berkshire, and I am godfather to her son, John. Richard really is a model baby, always happy and contented. He adores his bath and kicks and splashes the water, making the nursery floor look like a miniature flood. He is a perfect picture of babyhood. This is a quotation from my nanny's diary. She looked after me and my two brothers, John and Michael. She was a highly qualified, English, and very professional lady, a caring and lovely person whom the three of us remembered with great affection. She was very much a part of the family, and she also had an excellent rapport with my parents. She stayed with the family through time spent in the UK, South Africa, and Southern Rhodesia until I was about 5 or 6. After she left, we remained in close touch, and the last time that we met was in 1982, when my son Ian was christened, in the same robes in which I was christened. She died shortly after that event. However, in 2015, an amazing coincidence happened. A very good friend of mine, who was Lieutenant Governor of Guernsey, Air Marshal Peter Walker, very sadly and suddenly died, aged just 65. I went to his funeral in the RAF Church St. Clement Danes, and then to the reception at the RAF Club afterwards in Piccadilly, where there was a package waiting for me. I picked it up, but did not open it until I got home, and in it was a book. First of all, there was a note from the office of His Excellency, the Lieutenant Governor of Guernsey. Then there was a letter from this lady who obviously had the same nanny as me, as did her mother. She lived in Guernsey, knew Peter Walker, and asked if he knew me. He did, we were good friends, and asked if he could convey the diary. Very sadly, he was unable to deliver the diary personally, but his wife Linda left it for me at the club. I opened it, and what a surprise! It was really the story of my first 6 months in this world, in a report kept by my nanny. It was the first time that I even knew that the diary existed at age 70. The world is full of surprises. All I can say is that I was the perfect baby, or at least that is the way I was described. Actually, my mother always used to tell me that I was a very good child until I was about 8. I am the eldest of 3 brothers, with an age difference of 3 and a quarter years between us. We were always close, very close, and have been throughout our lives. My middle brother John, known as Johnny, is 15 months younger than me, and like me, he was educated at Michaelhouse and went on to attend the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. As I have already said, Johnny and I were close, but there was always a love-hate relationship that existed between us, and at times we fought like hell, often arguing for the sake of arguing, particularly when our wives were present. They would ask, "What are you two arguing about? You are saying exactly the same thing." In a bit of a rollercoaster life, John was always an entrepreneur. In this capacity, he sometimes took risks, he made money, and he lost money. He passed away in 2015, and he is missed. He was a dedicated family man who loved life and people, and he was well supported by his lovely wife, Fran, herself the daughter of another Ceylon tea planter. They have 3 daughters. Michael, known as Mike, is my youngest brother, 2 years younger than John. He too attended Michaelhouse and went on to Natal University to study economics. Mike, after spending most of his working life in Johannesburg, now lives in the Cape with his wife Di. He is a solid character who learned much from the mistakes of his 2 elder brothers. He retired as the chief executive of the South African Forestry Association. Mike has a son and daughter from his first marriage to Bobby, plus a stepson, James. We boys had a very happy family life, and from my perspective, an upbringing that can be divided into 2 phases, one in the UK and the other in South Africa. Until I was aged 12, we seemed to be moving house often, especially whilst my father was still serving in the RAF. I was born in Maidstone on the 27th of January 1945, when my parents were living in Kent. My brother John was also born in Maidstone. By the time I was 2 years old, we had lived in both the UK and Southern Rhodesia. We had travelled to and from South Africa by Union Castle ship, the Athlone Castle, I recall. I do not remember anything from this period in my life, apart from a vague memory of going up Table Mountain in Cape Town in a cable car. I must then have been aged 2, and we must have been on our way back to the UK. On our return from Africa in 1947, we first lived in a village near Bournemouth, where my brother Mike was born. I can remember rabbits in the garden where we lived, but that is about all. I think it must have been in late 1948 that we moved to a lovely house in Iver, Bucks, called The Beeches. It was from this time onwards that my memory becomes clearer. The Beeches was the first of 2 houses that we lived in Iver. The second was called The Homestead, which I remember as not being as nice as The Beeches. John and I were absolute tearabouts on our tricycles and treated them like go-karts. We were dangerous, and no more so than when Mike, just walking, also wanted to play. I am afraid that he did not get much sympathy from his elder brothers. It was whilst living at Iver that John and I went to our first school, Westfield, which was very close to where we lived. I enjoyed my time there, but I am not so sure about John. He played truant on a number of occasions. I also remember being asked to take John home on his first day at school because he had wet his trousers, obviously a traumatic experience, and I hasten to add that that was the only time. One of the other things that I remember about our time in Iver was spending a lot of time visiting the farm at the bottom of the road, run by a lovely family called the Judds. Their lifestyle really attracted my interest, and I immediately felt a great love for both nature and the countryside. Haystacks were a great attraction to play in and around. Happy days. I also used to help the milkman from United Dairies every morning with his milk round. It meant a very early start, but I did not mind that, and I was getting paid 6 pence per round. I remember well how rich I felt when I had amassed 19 shillings, but that amount of money could go a long way in those days. I also remember how I used to go and watch trains, and in particular the great steam trains that operated on the Great Western Railway line, a fabulous sight. I was a train spotter, and I noted the numbers of every train. I remember a bonfire in the garden and seeing a Johnson's baby powder tin in the fire. Why do I remember this? Because I tried to pluck the tin from the fire. What a silly boy. I badly burnt my hand, but lesson learned. Finally, I can remember going with the family to visit some good friends who lived nearby, an army brigadier called Crowdy and his family. I ended up in disgrace when I let his birds out of their cage, never to be seen again. I went on from nursery to a prep school called Long Close in Upton Road, Slough. The school was housed in a very large old house with views towards Windsor Castle. Initially, I went as a day boy, but not for very long, because my parents moved to Wilmslow in Cheshire, and I became a boarder for the first time at just 7 years old. John had joined me at Long Close by this time, and he was boarding at age 6. There weren't many boarders at the school, and we all lived in one dormitory. I remember pillow fights, walks to church on Sundays, and playing in the grounds of the school, in particular at weekends. In the summer, there was a nice swimming pool to occupy our time. By the time I was 7, I had become an accomplished swimmer, and I was winning everything at both swimming and diving. However, one weekend, I dived into the swimming pool at Long Close and hit my head on the bottom of the pool. Apart from giving me a big shock, and I can't remember whether or not I knocked myself out, for a number of years after that event, I lost my nerve when it came to diving, with the notable exception of doing racing dives at the start of swimming races. I remained unbeatable in the pool. I remember being generally happy at Long Close, but I also remember feeling homesick at the start of each term. School is not the same as home. John was the same, and I know that my mother found it all a very traumatic experience. She always hated her boys being away from home. Holiday time was also very special, always, and not just because we were at home, but also because, usually, several times per year, we would go to Jersey, where my maternal grandparents lived. My grandmother came from a Jersey family called Ogier, and was one of 13 children, many of whom lived until they were over 100 years old. I loved our holidays in Jersey, and I still have a deep love for the island, the beaches, the lovely coves, Jersey cows, new potatoes, everything. It was sad when my grandfather suddenly died, but my grandmother then lived in a large apartment in St. Helier, number 45, the Esplanade, overlooking St. Aubyn's Bay, Elizabeth Castle, the harbour. The views were fantastic. My brothers and I used to watch for the daily mail ship to appear round Corbière Point, and then we would all race down to the entrance of the harbour, arriving just as the ship was coming through the entrance. We would then watch passenger disembarkation and the unloading of freight. The harbour was a fascinating place, and we used to spend many hours just looking at all the busy activity. There was so much to see, and it was all so new and fascinating. My grandmother was a very special person, very kind to us boys. In particular, we used to love the cream teas that she would buy for us when we visited the biggest shop in St. Helier called Voisin's. The Voisin family were also our relations. My grandmother also used to make the most delicious fudge. I used to enjoy the dizzy feeling that I got from eating the fudge. It gave me a real kick. Most summers we would spend the whole holiday on Jersey. The island became like a second home. I also remember learning all about the German occupation during World War II, which, of course, affected the lives of most of my grandmother's family. How the islanders must have suffered. Whilst we were in Jersey, my father used to spend much of the time at work back on the mainland, but he would regularly fly a chipmunk to the island for weekends, and I can well remember the excitement of going to meet him at Jersey Airport. He would also take a few weeks' leave to be with his family. During our time living in Wilmslow, we lived in an officer's married quarter on the RAF base there. But because John and I were away most of the year at boarding school, and in the school holidays we were so often in Jersey, we were not there very much. However, I do remember one occasion when we had been playing down near the railway line. John, in particular, was a bit of a troublemaker, and on this occasion he had set fire to the grass embankment by the rail track. This led to the fire service being called, and a pretty severe ticking off for both of us at home, me because I was the eldest and should have been able to stop John. Some hope. If you knew my brother, you would know that he very much had a mind of his own all of his life. After a few years at Wilmslow, my father was posted to the Air Ministry in London, and we moved to Leeds Village in Kent, where my parents bought a lovely house in the village, Willow Tree House. The house was on the outskirts of the village, opposite the church. It was also only a short walk to the village shops, in particular a sweet shop owned, as I recall, by a lady called Tuck. Very appropriate. There was also a butcher, and I remember on a number of occasions our pet dachshund sneaking into the shop, only to re-emerge with a string of sausages in his mouth, followed by an irate butcher. Also worthy of mention, my parents bought the house from the family of a famous test pilot, Mike Lithgow, who very sadly was killed whilst flight testing a commercial BAC-111 prototype in 1963. Yet another aviation connection in my life. We lived in Leeds Village for about 4 years, and these were some of the happiest years of my life. It was bliss to live in such an idyllic village and English countryside environment. The house itself had a lot of space and 6 or 7 bedrooms.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?